You know, the online world is great for so many things. It's great for making you laugh, it's great for entertainment, and every now and again you come across ideas or people that literally blow your mind. But I still think some of my best thinking happens offline. So join me, Nessa, on Offline Thoughts as I chat about some of the things I think about when I'm not online. I'm really glad you're listening, and I hope you enjoy the episode. So the other day, I was listening to The Diary of a CEO, which is like this podcast or this podcaster who has like some really good guests on there. And he had on this occasion, Trevor Noah. And if you haven't come across Trevor Noah, he's a comedian. Although I have to say, I don't really know him much from his comedy. It's not necessarily my type of comedy, but I really enjoyed him on The Daily Show. And then I also really loved his book. He's got a book called Born a Crime, and it's about his experiences having been born into apartheid. And so what he was talking about on this podcast was that he had grown up in an unsafe home. And because of having grown up in an unsafe home, it caused him to become like super hypersensitive to like danger or signals that danger was coming. And the reason the home was unsafe was that his stepfather was incredibly violent. He was a violent man. He beat on his mother regularly. He actually shot her in the head, after years of being together, and luckily she survived. But because he grew up in like this violent, like tumultuous home, he was just always hypersensitive to the mood of the house, whether, you know, their stepfather was going to be violent that day or at that time. So he said it got to the stage where he could even tell from like the footsteps, the kinds of footsteps his stepfather was taking in like another room, or from how the stepfather called his name, or from how the stepfather closed the door. Just from like those subtle signs, he could predict or tell what mood he was in and whether, you know, his mother was safe. He spoke as well about the long-term consequences of that. And some of them are not necessarily all bad, but he said that even to this day as an adult, he's very good at being able to tell like the mood of the room and whether there's tension or the point at which at a party, for example, the energy goes from everybody having a good time to there's just some tension that tells him that violence is going to erupt and then he'll leave, or with friends when a disagreement is going to take place and he's able to intervene. So when he was talking about all this, it was really an aha moment, because I am definitely the kind of person who is very good at like predicting things. Like one of the things that my partner finds very annoying is that when we're watching films or shows or documentaries, I can tell like 9 times out of 10, I can honestly tell you what's going to happen before even like a third way through the film. Sometimes like within like the first opening scenes of the film, or in my personal life, even though in the last episode I talked about like having bad friends, like find myself in a situation where I'm friends with people who aren't good all the time, 99% of the time, it's not that I don't see that they're bad, it's that I talk myself out of it. And outside my friendships, I'm always able to tell, for example, in the relationships of my friends and family, like when things aren't well, when like people are putting up a pretense, like they're presenting a unified front or a happy front, but I can tell when there's something wrong, like when there is something about the relationship where I feel like they're trying to hide that from me or hide it from friends and family in general. Or another example is just in general, I honestly can't say that there has ever been a bad story that has come out about somebody that I know or have known or has been in my personal sphere that I haven't like had already gotten spidey senses about. So when Trevor Noah was talking about his experiences, it was a real like aha moment for me, as I said, like it really connected the dots. And that's the beauty of taking in different types of content, because you come across things that you wouldn't have thought about, or people phrase things in a particular way that clicks for you, or they give you language to an experience you've had but didn't know quite how to explain it. So when he was talking about that hypersensitivity and being able to like read the room and read people and read micro expressions and being very good at predicting what's going to happen in his personal life, like I know that that's my experience as well, because although I didn't grow up in a physically abusive home, I grew up in an unsafe situation for a lot of my childhood. The reason why it was unsafe, you know, wasn't coming from inside the house, but we fled a war in my country, and because of that we were refugees for most of my childhood, really up until maybe 10 or 11, and we bounced around from country to country, and we were around all kinds of people, were in like just different situations where I was always sort of like told to be distrustful, and for good cause. So for example, when I was in South Africa, we had just arrived there. We didn't stay there for more than a couple of years, but we had arrived there, and there was this organization that was run by Rwandan people. And initially what we thought was happening was that they were trying to help. I mean, that's what their mandate was. That's what they said the purpose of the organization was. So initially we thought that they were trying to help us get like citizenship in South Africa, helping us getting settled, like finding a home, like finding a school, like those kinds of things. But it turned out what this organization was doing was that they were collecting information on Rwandan people, Rwandan names, like their names, their ages, like their story, like basically any information they could get their hands on. And their intention was to send that information back to the Rwandan government in an attempt to basically have them sent back. So automatically, just a very sinister organization. But what that does to a young child experiencing this, and to a family experiencing this, is that the parents necessarily have to teach their children to be incredibly discerning and distrustful of people, and to be very good at working out what their intentions are, or whether they mean the children and the family harm. And so as a child, like, you're kind of on hyper aware mode all the time, like especially around adults, but also children, because sometimes people send their children to ask questions of other children in an attempt to like gather information or to like find out things about the parents, especially when the parents aren't forthcoming about information because they feel unsafe. So I was just super hyper aware of like keeping family secrets, like keeping our family business private, not telling people where we'd been, not telling people why we were there, not telling people about just anything like personal or anything that might compromise our safety in some way. And so that's what I connected with when Trevor Noah was talking about growing up in an unsafe home. I connected it to that feeling of like hyper aware mode of everybody that comes into your life. And the only time you really feel safe and like you can let down your walls and let down your defense system is when you're in your home with your family. But what that episode made me think about outside my own experiences and outside what Trevor Noah was describing was this idea that people who have been sheltered in their own personal lives, or who thankfully have come from a very stable home life, sometimes, like, the downside of that, if you can describe it as a downside, is that they aren't necessarily good at discerning when people are bad, because they haven't had as much practice, because there hasn't been a need for them to develop that skill in such a deep way. So that's what I'd like to talk about in this episode. I'd like to talk about like telltale signs or ways in which you can discern that people are bad. And I'm going to do this across like different subjects. The first thing I'd like to cover is how to tell when somebody is like a sexual creep or a sexual predator. I feel like I'm obsessed with this subject, but honestly, it takes up so much mental real estate in my life. So one of the ways you can tell is sometimes people, like, they're de facto defense of somebody tells you about who they are aligned with. How you can see this is when somebody, like a famous person, a celebrity, comes out and they have been accused of something. Like, take P. Diddy, for like, that's happening right now, but also think back to like the Harvey Weinsteins, think back to the Bill Cosbys, think back to like all these like prolific sexual villains who have been exposed as being sexual predators or sexual creeps. What always strikes me about these stories is how quickly people, usually men, I'm specifically talking about men here, how they de facto take their side. So a story has come out, like one, usually it's first is one victim and then it trickles down to like a whole bunch of victims that come out. But in the initial stages, they will presume that the man who's been accused of being a sexual predator is like innocent. They'll say all kinds of things like maybe they are just after money, maybe they're lying, maybe they regretted it, maybe they were used or they feel used and so they're trying to get like revenge on this person. Maybe the rapist or creep didn't mean to hurt them. Maybe the victim misunderstood what the nature of the relationship was. All kinds of things. And the reason why I think this is a very good telltale sign that somebody themselves is probably, if not directly, a creep or a predator, is certainly like a predator apologist. And also you can assume that you should be wary of this person, at least when it comes to this subject matter, is that given that they weren't there, they don't know the person, like personally, they usually aren't even invested in that person, the person being accused in any other way. So with Harvey Weinstein, all these men coming out to defend him, it's not as though they could have told you like what films Harvey Weinstein produced. They might not even have been able to pick him up in a lineup, but somehow they were going to bat for him so hard, you know? So why? They're not invested in him in any other way. They don't know him personally. It's not a friend or a family member or a cousin or anything like that. They weren't there. They weren't there in the room when the woman alleges what she alleges. And then on top of that, like these people don't even pay them. It's not as though it's like an employee who's like afraid of losing their job. So they're kind of like just parroting or saying what needs to be said. Like often these men who come out and defend these predators are doing it in such an impassioned way and in a way that feels very irrational for all the reasons that I've just given. And given that the choice they've made, so the choice presented to them, when any story comes out about a sexual violation, given that the public never knows really what happened, you have the choice of giving the benefit of the doubt to the victim or the benefit of the doubt to the predator. And if the men in your life, if you see that the majority of time or as the default, they give the benefit of the doubt to the predator and not to the victim, it tells you a lot about where their values lie, who they are aligned with, and also how they view sexual assault or sexual abuse. And it should definitely be a red flag that puts you on high alert that they are either aligned with this person because they fundamentally like don't think sexual abuse is that bad, or that they themselves have done things that are questionable, on the edge, or even just downright criminal. And they're basically defending themselves and their actions through the person who's accused right now. It's almost as though they see in these Harvey Weinsteins, in these Bill Cosbys, in these P. Diddy's, it's like they see themselves and they're defending their actions through this person that they have never met, might never meet, you know, don't know personally, have no relationship with that person. But somehow they always find themselves aligning with the perpetrator or the accused perpetrator as opposed to the victim. I think that's a massive red flag. The second telltale sign to know if somebody's like a creep or a predator is if they like listened, followed, supported people like Andrew Tate. I'm using Andrew Tate as an example right now, but you can insert people who are like Andrew Tate. So people, for example, who used to listen to Kevin Samuel when he was alive. And the reason I say this is that with people like Andrew Tate, even before he was charged with human trafficking and rape, amongst all the other things he's been charged with, he's a man who spoke openly about how to abuse women in explicit terms, in unambiguous terms. So he would talk about getting girls as young as you could so that you could train them up. He spoke about physical abuse being used against like girls and women to keep them in control. He spoke about sexually exploiting them. He spoke about how they should be or could be discarded. He talked about how women over the age of 25 are like horse. That's a language that he uses. He spoke about all kinds of sinister things. And so given, and by the way, when I say explicit, this is really explicit, because there are some people where like they'll say really slimy, disgusting things, but they'll hide it within things that they say. They'll almost like make it sound like they're not saying what they're saying. They might present it as like concern for women. So they'll do like that thing where people victim blame, but they're not doing it like in an explicit way, like it's women's fault, but they'll do it in a way where they are still saying the same thing, but it's more difficult to pick up that that's what they have said. You know, when you walk away from a conversation and you feel uncomfortable, but you have to go home and really think about what it was about the person or what it was about the phrasing of what somebody said that was uncomfortable or that made you feel uncomfortable. So some creepsters like are like that, you know? But for people like Andrew Tate, this was somebody where there was literally no ambiguity about his predatoriness, about his creepiness, about his sliminess. And on top of that, he spoke about it publicly at every opportunity that he had, whether it was on Instagram or YouTube or Twitter or in media publications. Like, this guy would talk about the things he spoke about all the time. And so for men to see that content, see how reviled he is amongst like women and like men who aren't predators, for them to still follow him and be associated with him and continue to listen to him already tells you the kind of person that they are, in that they hold at least some of those beliefs that he has. But I would argue that they're probably the same type of people. Because for men who say like they followed Andrew Tate or follow Andrew Tate because he teaches men like how to self-improve or teaches them self-development or teaches them discipline or teaches them self-defense or teaches them financial skills, there are literally hundreds, if not thousands of coaches online that do the exact same thing that aren't confirmed predators. And so for these men who follow and support Andrew Tate to kind of like try to sell us the idea that what they're getting out of Andrew Tate is all this other stuff that I've mentioned around self-development is just a complete and utter lie. Like, Andrew Tate's primary brand identity, the thing that he is well known for or most known for, is the fact that he's a misogynist. So men who have, you know, who followed his podcast when he still had his podcast, or who followed him on YouTube, or who retweeted the things he said, or used his talking points in public and in their private life, like, rest assured, the reason why they are such stands of his is because he says things that they wish they could say themselves in their personal lives. The third thing I would say about men who are creeps or predators, or I would say in this, with this subpoint, men who hate women, who have no respect for women, who are like covert misogynist, I would say men who use the words bitch, the men who use the word whore, the men who use the word slut as their, like, as part of their vocabulary. Like, it's actually very extremist language. Like, the average decent man would never use that language, and he would certainly never use that language as part of his like everyday vocabulary. And I guarantee you, when he was using that word, those words or those slurs would be in situations where he was hurling a slur word against a woman, maybe in like the course of a fight. But even most men in the course of a fight would never dare utter those words, because again, it is extreme language to use. And the reason why like these covert misogynistic men don't realize that language, like words like bitch, whore, slut, etc., are slurs or extreme language, is because they spend so much time in an echo chamber around incels, around men who hate women, around or in chat rooms where they talk about these types of things, where they hurl abuse at women, talk about women in a negative way, talk about like just casualized misogynistic things amongst each other. They spend so much time in these types of echo chambers that when they come into the real world, they literally don't know that that is extremist language that they're using. They don't realize that that is language that is socially unacceptable, or that for the most person who heard that, in most contexts, like, I don't care if you're at a dinner party or out for drinks with friends, like, hearing a man refer to a woman as a whore or a slut or a bitch, even in like quote unquote jokes, it's sort of like a schism. Like it causes you to kind of like come out of yourself for a moment because it's such a shocking thing to say. But they don't realize it's shocking because they spend primarily their time around people who say similar things and who hold similar beliefs. It kind of makes me think about when men, actually not men, people in general, men and women who are like deep into pornography to the point where it almost feels like if they're not addicted, they're certainly in the realm of abusing pornography or using it in a way that is, that feels like an addiction. They spend so much time in that world that sometimes they become desensitized and don't know that some of the words that they use are extreme words or are socially unacceptable words or are words where the average person who doesn't live in that world, who doesn't consume pornography or doesn't consume pornography in that extreme way would like find like really shocking. So you might be talking to somebody and let's say the topic of sex or something to do with the sexual organs comes up. And let's say they have to refer to like breasts. They won't say breasts or they won't like use a euphemism for breasts. They'll say something like tits. Or when it comes to talking about a vagina or like a woman's genitals, they won't say it in that way or say it in a way where it's socially acceptable or permissible. They'll use the word pussy. Or instead of saying penis or something euphemistic like that refers to like a man's genitals, they'll say cock, or they'll randomly reference like extreme forms of sex without realizing that those acts of sex that they have referenced casually in public settings are extreme forms of sex. Like, for example, they might just randomly talk about choking or how they like choking or how they choked somebody, or they might talk about wanting or demanding of their partners to do fisting or anal or things like that, you know? And they'll say it in a way where, although the room will kind of like, the room will kind of be like, you know, when like the room takes in a silent sort of like intake of breath because what's been said is like low key, like disturbing or like weird or odd or socially not permissible, they won't notice that that has just happened, or they might notice, but before they said it, they didn't realize that that was not acceptable. And the only reason that is the case is because they have kind of become desensitized about knowing what's the appropriate language to use because they spend so much time in like porn, like in pornography or porn world. It's literally the same thing when it comes to like incels or misogynistic men who spend a lot of time, usually online, around other men who hate women. They use language that speaks to their hatred of women. They casually denigrate women. And this language ends up seeping into their everyday vocabulary. And eventually that language seeps out in a casual social setting in a way where they don't realize that that's happening. So I would say when you hear a man use that language, when they like randomly say or casually use the words bitch or whore or slut or casually just reference extremist forms of sex, like be on high alert that chances are he doesn't like women or doesn't respect women, or even worse than that, like you might not even be safe around that person. And when I say safe, I don't even necessarily mean that they will like sexually violate you. I don't, like, you can be unsafe in different ways. So I used to, or sometimes I listen to them. There's like these YouTubers called Fresh and Fit, and they do like reviews of like things that have happened in the pop world, or they're social commentators, I guess you could say. And every now and again, you'll be watching a video, and they're, by the way, they're hyper-focused on, like, women doing bad things. So they love it when a woman is behaving inappropriately or has done something that is socially unacceptable. They really go ham. And whilst they're going ham, like, every now and again, they'll just randomly, like, refer to the woman as a whore or casually talk about sluts or casually talk about just really misogynistic language. But what's interesting about Fresh and Fit is that they're very charismatic. They're very gentle. They're very, like, they're not obviously villainous, you know, like they're clearly like nice people, I'd imagine, for the most part, but they clearly hold views that tell me that they hate women, or they don't like women, or they don't respect women, or they view themselves as victims of women in some way. And the reason why I'd say people like that are dangerous as well is that sometimes the danger comes from the people around you not being the types of people who would intervene on your behalf or who would put you in compromising situations. So if they believe, for example, that women are whores and sluts, maybe it means that if a female friend is sexually assaulted, they won't defend that person. Or they'll allow a friend of theirs that they know is like creepy or violates women's boundaries in other micro ways, or who is just like a bad egg, who's not a safe guy, they'll allow that person around their friend. Or God forbid, you know, if something does happen, they won't believe that woman, because in their head, like, most women lie about sexual assault, or most women are whores or sluts who like regret sex and try to villainize the man. And so again, those types of people aren't compromising your safety in the sense that they're not doing anything to you. They're not the ones doing something to you, but they can compromise your safety in other ways, namely in that they won't keep you safe, or they'll even put you in harm's way by actively denying the reality of things. The reality of things being that men are predators against women. Like, 95% of the predatoriness in the sexual domain is perpetrated by men. And so people should be on high alert that women's safety isn't compromised, you know? And the problem with like these covert misogynists who view themselves as victims and view women inherently as being like liars or exaggerators when it comes to this is that whilst they won't be like the Harvey Weinsteins or the Bill Cosbys of the world, they'll certainly be the people who allow or permit or turn a blind eye to women's suffering. So again, like, I feel like if you hear these words being used, it's a red flag that you're probably not safe as a woman around that person, and that you should be wary about your safety. You know, not necessarily that they themselves are going to hurt you, but know that you're not in a safe space when it comes to these people. Now, the next category of types of traits that I'm going to speak about is people who display examples of self-hatred, or who display examples of having like deeply ingrained and deeply set inferiority complexes. And the reason why I think these people are unsafe is because sometimes when people are so desperate to be accepted by the majority group, in this case, white people in general, they will do so at your expense, or they will do it in such a way where your well-being or your interests are compromised. Now, I think in a couple of episodes ago, I spoke about how like Asian Americans had banded together to have affirmative action in education that was implemented after the Civil Rights Bill was passed and African Americans got the right to be citizens for the first time, how they banded together to get that dismantled. That's an example of a group of people who are so desperate to be ingratiated into like the white community that they're literally willing to become the spokespeople for extreme right-wing groups, because a white organization could never or unlikely would have been able to successfully like pass that legislation. But because there were people of color, they were basically able to do their dirty bidding. So that's the next category. And like, telltale signs you can recognize this in people, you can suspect that they might be that kind of person, is anybody who like refers to themselves as a coconut, or refers to themselves as like an Oreo, or like any form of that sort of sentiment or language. And if you haven't come across the term before, it's basically a term that people use to say that they don't display like the typical characteristics that is typical for their group. And this is a term that obviously only applies to people of color, hence the term like coconut, like basically black or brown on the outside, but white on the inside, or Oreo, black or brown on the outside, white on the inside. And the reason why I think this is like negative, or actually let me take it a step backwards and talk about the kinds of things that they say. So usually what they pick out as being atypical for people of color, they'll say things like, they like to read, but I'll use a black example just because that's what I'm most familiar with. But I've obviously heard it in other contexts. Like I've heard it in South Asians, I've heard it in East Asians, I've heard it in Latinos, I've heard it in other people of color. But I'll focus on this on Africans in general or black people in general. So they might say things like, I'm a coconut because I like to read, or I'm intelligent or nerdy or geeky, or I'm really into the arts. So I love theater, I love opera. Or they might say that I'm like a gaming nerd. And they'll use that as like a personality. Or they'll say things like, I'm well-spoken, or I don't like rap, or insert whatever like microaggression language that they might use to tell you or tell people that they're basically not black. They're not like other black people. And what they've done there is obvious in that they've put all the positive characteristics in the white category, and they've simultaneously put all the negative characteristics in the black category. So if somebody says, I'm actually white on the inside, LOL, because I like to read, what they're saying is that African-Americans don't like to read, despite like all the contributors to like American literature and all the people across the world who have written amazing books and read every single day. Or they'll say, when they say, I'm a coconut because I'm intelligent, they're literally telling you that they think black people as a whole are stupid. Or when they say that they're into the arts and they like theater and they like opera, they're making it seem as though black people aren't like on in theater shows, or they're not on Broadway, or they're not into the arts as well. You know what I mean? Or when they're saying things like they are well spoken, they're saying it as though black people or African people aren't well spoken. So again, like it's often dog whistle, or is like 99 times out of 100 dog whistle for self-hatred. And it always comes across as like a humble brag, but it's actually not a humble brag because they're ultimately denigrating themselves and people who look like them. And they're also doing that thing that racists do where they're painting like all black people or all people of color as a monolith. So what they're saying in that breath is they're saying that all the people that look like them are, insert all the negative things that I've just referenced, and then they are special and separate from them because they don't display these like similar characteristics. And by the way, they rarely ever apply that sort of negative caricature or stereotypes to the group they are trying to be a part of. So like for me, when I hear that term, when somebody refers to themselves as like a coconut, already like my spidey senses are on edge. And to be honest, it gives me the ick. But outside the ick, it makes me think like, okay, well, this is clearly somebody I need to be cautious about, in the sense that you have people like Kanye West, who clearly, although I did talk about in the last episode that I did on Kanye West that I wasn't going to speak about him anymore, but briefly, you've got people like Kanye West who literally do things that are against black people's interests, like go on live television and talk about how slavery was a choice and how slavery wasn't that bad, or is photographed with Donald Trump, who literally intends and wants to deport people of color. So again, like I would say that these people aren't neutral. They aren't like zero risks. They're not people that you should sort of like roll your eyes at and just sort of like dismiss, because again, like they can do all kinds of things. And I've spoken about how they can do things when they have some power, like with people like Kanye West, for example, but even in your private life, like they are the person who will pretend like the racism that you experienced didn't happen. You know, like when let's say your employer discriminates against you and you have to take them to like an employment tribunal, they are literally the person of color that your workplace will roll out to speak about how racism can't be real at the company because they didn't experience racism. So again, like your spidey senses should like be aware that this person isn't a safe person, in the sense that they're not somebody you can rely on. And in fact, you probably shouldn't tell them too much about yourself. Outside the racial dynamic or sphere, when it comes to women, like one of the things that I notice is when people say things like, I'm not like other girls, or another way of saying this is that I usually have only male friends or prefer the company and friendship of men or boys or guys or whatever it is. And like what I've just spoken about, what that tells you is that the person has put all the positive characteristics in the male category, and they've put all the negative characteristics in the female category, because that's literally the only way you can explain the idea that they believe that most or all women are not worthy of friendship or are not good friends, but in general, men as a whole are good for friendships. And usually, you know, in terms of like negative caricature or stereotyping of women, like women who say things like, I'm not like other girls, or I don't like women, or I think women are X, Y, and Z, the things that they'll say about women is, they'll say like, most women are bitchy, or most women are competitive, or most women are petty, or you can't trust most women around your husband, or most women are generally untrustworthy, or they're like emotional in a way that means that they can't be trusted. So again, like, literally what they've done is they've put all the negative characteristics in the female category, and they've put all the positive characteristics in the male category. And so what they're telling you is that they simultaneously like worship men, and that they also at the same time have great contempt for women, and also therefore themselves. And again, like going back to the election of Donald Trump, you know, it goes without saying how shocking it is, not only like the first time like Trump came into office, but also the second time. It goes without saying how shocking it is that so many women, despite what was at stake, like still voted for him. Like despite knowing that he talks about grabbing women by their genitals, despite the fact that he was heavily connected to Jeffrey Epstein at the time, although he's tried to distance himself now, like after Jeffrey Epstein's like arrest and charge and suicide. But back in the day, he was photographed multiple times being with him. And I also recall seeing a document a long time ago, which I can't for the life of me find again, where a woman alleges a woman, she was a child at the time, she was a teenager at the time, alleges that he sexually assaulted her, and all the other creepy things that we know about him. So it's sort of like, these women know all these things about him. And the reason we know about these things as well is that they've been heavily publicized. Like, honestly, like, there's been so much media coverage about all the terrible things that Donald Trump has done against women, about how he's a sexual predator, about how he's a sexual deviant, all this stuff. And so for women for white women to vote for him in such large numbers really speaks to the fact that they have really internalized self-hatred, in the sense that they're willing to vote for somebody who will plan or intends to do things that doesn't benefit women, and in fact actively makes women's lives worse off in so many ways. And the reason why, like, women who say things like, you know, women in general are this, that, and the other, and talking negatively about women as like the standard way of being, is that, like, we know all we know about men. Like, we know the things that men do to women. We know about the rates of offending against women. We know the rates of femicide. We know all these like undeniable stats about men that really tell us that if you're going to back any horse in terms of like who is like less bad or who is less dangerous or who like can be trusted more, like it's not even close. Ask the average man and the average woman, if you had to leave your child in the care of a stranger, would you prefer to leave them in the care of a man or in the care of a woman that you don't know? Literally 99% of people will choose the woman, because we know, despite what people may say out loud, that that child is going to be inherently safer with the woman. And so therefore, the women who say these things like women can't be trusted, or women are just as bad as men, or that's why I prefer the company of women. That's why I prefer the company of men over the company of women. Like, not only is it delusional, but it's actually very concerning about what it says about how they view the safety of the women in their lives, and also what it means about how they kind of put themselves in compromising situations. For me, like, that's kind of a scary thought. Like, going to, even the idea of going to an all-male party as the only woman is terrifying to me. Never mind just like casually in my everyday life, being predominantly or exclusively being surrounded by men, it feels, yeah, it feels, I want to say the word sad, but also from the perspective of other women, like, that's not even the kind of friend you would want around you anyway, because again, it's the kind of friend who probably is going to victim blame you when you talk about like sexual violations you may experience. They're the kind of person who will ask you like what you were wearing, why you were drunk, why you were at that party, you know, why you didn't cut them off at the first sign that they might not be as friend. You know what I mean? It's not a safe person to be around. Another example of people who display signs that they have feelings of self-hatred that you should be wary of is people who say things like, I don't identify, and then like insert whatever the identity marker is. The first person that pops into my mind is when I think about Raven Simone. And if you don't know her, she's like an actress who used to be on Disney. She was also actually first, she was on the Bill Cosby show as a little girl. And then later on, she went on to be on the show called That's So Raven on Disney that me and my sisters like used to love. And then she also was in the show called The Proud Family, which was like a cartoon show. She did a voiceover for that. She also did a voiceover for like this other show on Disney that was like a cartoon, but she was like a superhero thing. So she's been in loads of like really successful franchises. And one of the things about Raven Simone is that when she was on the Oprah show, this must have been like 10 years ago at this stage, she's on the Oprah show, which was supposed to be a fluff piece of basically just going through her career and all the great things that she has done and where she's at now and what she hopes for the future. And in the course of that interview, she ends up saying something to the effect of, I don't identify as an African American. And what's really funny about that interview, actually, and you can still go and check it out, it's on YouTube. What's funny about that interview is that you can clearly see Oprah trying to save her because she clearly likes Raven and she wishes Raven well. So she tries to rephrase for Raven and tries to sort of clarify that, I'm sure that's not what you meant, but that's what people might hear, giving her basically an opportunity to clarify that that's not what she meant. But she basically like doubles down and she says, like, I said what I said, like, I'm not an African American, I'm an American. And at the time, it was actually like really salacious news, salacious in the sense that it was just so shocking. And there was like a lot of columns that were like writing about what it means and whether she was right or wrong. And actually, she experienced a lot of like fallout from that statement and lost a lot of fandom from that statement. And then the other thing that she has said in terms of like, I don't identify as, she says she doesn't identify as a gay woman or as a lesbian woman. And what's odd about that is that she literally is a lesbian woman. Like, she's married to a woman. She's got a wife that she's been with for a number of years. And so it's kind of weird that she doesn't identify with that label either. And the reason why people who say, I don't identify as, is an example of self-hatred in my view, is that especially when they use that label excuse, is that they don't apply that to other things. Like, as far as I'm concerned, like, a label really is just a descriptor in most circumstances. But bear in mind, this isn't a slur. So this isn't somebody calling her the F word, like the slur for, I mean, this is really for gay men. Or they're not calling her like a negative word for lesbian, like the D word. They're not saying any, it's a neutral, if you will, word. Same with the term African-American. It isn't a racial slur. It isn't like the N-word. It isn't like when they used to call people colored people. It isn't even calling them black people. Some people don't like to be called black because it feels dehumanizing, or it feels like it doesn't represent what they actually look like. So again, African-American just denotes the fact that you are of African descent, but you are American, as a distinct term, like from Native American, which means that you are native to the Americas, or as a difference to European Americans. I know we don't use that term, but I kind of feel like it will become the norm that we do that. So again, European Americans means that their origins are in Europe, but they are American. So again, there's nothing inherently offensive about African-American, and there's also nothing inherently offensive about the term lesbian or gay. And so for her to be repelled by these labels despite her being both those things, makes me think that clearly that there's a self-esteem issue, because it's not as though she doesn't like other labels. You know, like, she's happy, for example, to be called a woman. So she doesn't consider the fact that she's called a woman a slur. She doesn't consider her name a slur. And literally, a name is a labeling of human beings. Like, this human being is called this, and that's their label. So she's not against names. She's not against being gendered. She's not against being called an actress. Again, it's a label to describe or denote what somebody does for a living. She's not against labels that denote her wealth status. So I'm sure she has no offense or issues being called rich or well-off or wealthy. I'm sure she has no issues being called petite or a short woman. So again, she's not against labels as a whole, because if you're against labels, you would just be against labels. Maybe you just want to be known as, I don't know, label less. But again, I don't know how that would work in practice, because literally everything is a label. It's a descriptor. A label is a descriptor. And I understand people have an issue with negative descriptors or offensive descriptors or denigrating descriptors, but these terms are neutral in the sense that they don't connote or denote anything negative. So again, for me, it tells me that what she actually has an issue with is being identified as a gay person and being identified as a Black person. And the reason why she has an issue with being identified with those two things is because she must feel that it's negative to be those things. Because nobody has an issue being described as something positive. Nobody has like any issues around positive labels. If you're to call her smart or funny or intelligent or a superstar or insert whatever other label or adjective or descriptor, she has no issues with those descriptors, which again tells us it specifically is the idea of being associated with Black people. It specifically is the idea of being identified with gay people. Another example under this category is like people who exclusively date outside their racial group, or specifically date one group of people. And this group of people, I'm talking about like white people. So I'm talking about people of color who exclusively date white people. I always think that's definitely a sign of self-hatred. And the reason is very simple, in that the only way for them to, especially in the context of living in a metropolitan place, it's obviously different if you live in an all-white place. If you live in like a rural place or like a small town place in the white country, of course, that's who is available to you. So you're of course going to only date white people, because that's like 99.99% of people who are around you. I also don't talk about people who date all kinds of people. So people who date all kinds of groups, racial groups at different points in their lives. I'm not talking about those people either. I'm talking about people who literally only date white people as people of color. And the reason why it's an obvious example of self-hatred, as I said, is that they must have ascribed positive values exclusively to white people in a way that, like, the other side of that coin must mean they have put all the negative, like, categorizations on people who look like them. So it's very rare, for example, for Black men who exclusively date white women, or who like 9.9 times out of 10 date white women, to not express or have negative feelings about black women. Not necessarily other women, like they'll also like fetishize Latinos, but when it comes to like men who literally only like white women, they'll often talk about how Black women are not for them because they don't fulfill the things that white women fulfill. And they will literally say things that apply to all women. They'll say that white women are feminine, white women are submissive, white women are positive, white women are submissive, white women are insert whatever thing that literally most women do for most men, you know. And the reason why they say those things is because in their eyes, they only see it. They only see the good in white women, and they only see the bad in Black women. If that wasn't the case, they would clearly see that those qualities are pretty common qualities when it comes to women. It's kind of like people who say things like, you know, they hate us for our values, or they hate us for our American values, or they hate us for our British values. And then the question I always have in my head is like, what values are exclusive to American or British culture? You know what I mean? Because they'll invariably go on to say the most generic stuff. They'll say things like, we value freedom. We value liberty. We value like democracy. We value like family values. We value respect of women. Literally everybody has these values. They may manifest differently, or they may appear to different, like in different levels or different ratios. So for example, like places that are more patriarchal are going to have more patriarchal views towards women. But certainly you can't say that the patriarchy doesn't exist in America or doesn't exist in Britain. Clearly those things exist there as well. But people, when they say those statements, like they hate us for these values or these British values or these American values, what they have literally done is claimed for themselves all the positive adjectives that applies to all of humanity, and they've left all the bad for the other groups. That's literally the same thing when men who fetishize a specific group of people make those statements, like white women are submissive, kind, sweet, soft, gentle, like literally most women are like that. And what they've done is just left all the bad categories or characteristics or qualities for people who look like them as a justification for the fetishization of white women that they feel. Now, the final thing I'll talk about under this is one of the things that really irritate me. And actually, whenever I have been to these types of establishments, I always leave unhappy, feeling like they haven't treated me well, feeling like they haven't been gentle with me, feeling like they've been just like, there's been a lack of care, there's been an aggression about the way they've interacted with me. And so this is when literally African salons or black salons or salons that cater exclusively to a black clientele has like white women in their windows, on their walls, or if not white women, they only have like really light-skinned women as like the models that they have, the pictures of the models. Like, you know, when you go to a hair salon, you'll have like a picture of a woman whose hair is nicely done. Like if you walk by like a Tony and Guy poster, you'll see a white woman with like really slicked hair. Or, do you know what I mean? So in these types of salons, they have an exclusively black clientele, but they'll have like in their shop window, a white woman. And then you'll walk in and you'll see like probably Rihanna and Beyonce, and not just Rihanna and Beyonce when they're looking tan, but Rihanna and Beyonce when they're like on their lightest day. Or even the more brazy ones will have just literally white women. Like I've been to a hair salon not too far from where I live, where all the pictures are like of Audrey Hepburn and like other like white Hollywood like film stars. And in my latest sort of like confirmation of this is I got my hair done about a month ago, and I went to somewhere like not too far from my house. It's like a 15-minute bus journey. And I only go here when I'm desperate. I go here when I don't have a lot of time to go further out, or, you know, I can't get an appointment somewhere else. And so this is the kind of place that is literally what I've just described. Like you walk in and it's a white woman in the shop window, and sorry, my phone is going off. In the shop itself, in the salon itself, again, it's like pictures of Beyonce and Rihanna. The owner of the salon literally wears like the blondest, most bleached wig. She wears like green contacts. And what she does as well is that, at least like the last couple of times, she keeps forgetting. Like every time I go in, she forgets that she's already done my hair in the past. And so we have the same exchange over and over again. And so last time I went in, I had my hair in a clip, and I've got incredibly full hair, like really full hair, like really thick, full Afro hair, like when I wash it. And so I had it in a bun, so it was all like slicked back, so you couldn't see how big it is until she took it out of the clip. So we had agreed a price, and after, I think the price was something like £40 for a wash and blow dry and for her to put my hair in like two like French braids. And she takes out the clip, and then when she sees how big my hair is, she's like, oh, I'm gonna have to charge you more. But in my head, I'm like, why would you charge more money for people who are more African in their hair? Like, it's a black hair salon. It's an African shop, hair salon. Why should I, the person who doesn't relax my hair or who just has African, like natural African hair, like pay more money? That speaks to the idea that they don't like that. They don't like your Africanness despite being African women themselves. And then you can also tell that they don't like Africanness or they don't like African women's hair despite being an African hair salon in the way they're so aggressive with you. Like, when I'm in Rwanda and I'm getting my hair done, when I say it is such a gentle, lovely, relaxing experience, like the way they detangle my hair is so gentle. It almost feels like their hands are like the hands of little butterflies. Like, they're so gentle. When they wash it, there's no pulling and tugging. There's no aggression. There's actually no resistance in my hair. They use really nice products that smell well. They speak to you nicely. They don't charge you more because your hair is like not relaxed or because it's like fuller or like more naturally African. It's a night and day contrast. Whereas in this place, they pull and they tug and they make you feel so like tense and stressed out from the experience, because there's no part of the experience that's gentle or soft or kind or relaxing. And again, I maintain that it's again a reflection of the contempt or resentment or the hatred they have of Africanness and African hair in this specific example. Otherwise, they would realize that African hair is the most fragile hair because it's most prone to breaking, because it doesn't, like, the oils don't travel all the way to the bottom of the coil of the hair. And so it's more vulnerable to being dry and therefore more vulnerable to breakage, which is why you should like use your hair to like your fingers to detangle first before you use a hairbrush. And the reason why moisture is your friend, like getting a steam is so good for your hair, or locking in the moisture is so good for your hair. So when you go to these places and they're pulling and tugging and being so aggressive, last time she pulled my hair so much that I heard like an actual breakage, like a clump of hair coming out of my scalp. So again, like, it's a telltale sign that that person honestly like would prefer you were a white woman. They would prefer you have a wig. They would prefer you had your hair relaxed. They would prefer that you were like less African and more European. And it's evident in the posters around that they have on their shop front window and in the pictures they have framed in their wall, on their walls inside the salon. Like, it's just a massive telltale sign. Now, I had loads of other things I wanted to cover in this episode. I want to talk about like telltale signs that somebody's racist. I wanted to talk about telltale signs that somebody might be presenting themselves as a nice person, but you can tell a lot from like the people around them, even like the way their dog behaves or like other subtle cues that actually they're not as nice as they seem. But I think I'm going to save it for a future episode, just because we're nearing the 1 hour mark and I kind of have to go and do something else. So I really hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did like the episode, I'd really appreciate it if you left me a 5-star review wherever you get your podcasts from. And, you know, have a great week in the meantime, and I'll see you next Monday.